I mean, we do it not for ourselves, for a revolutionary organization. You kill my mate for that, too? I'm very sorry, said the boy. I cannot tell you how badly I feel about that. Don't try, said Harry. You see, the boy said, speaking quietly, this man, Roberto, is bad. He's a good revolutionary, but a bad man. He kills so much in the time of Machado, he gets to like it. He thinks it is funny to kill. He kills in a good cause, of course. The best cause. He looked back at Roberto, who sat now in one of the fishing chairs in the stern, the Thompson gun across his lap, looking back at the white boats, which were, Harry saw, much smaller now. What you got to drink? Roberto called from the stern. Nothing, Harry said. I drink my own, then, Roberto said. One of the other Cubans lay on one of the seats built over the gas tanks. He looked seasick already. The other was obviously seasick too, but still sitting up. Looking back, Harry saw a lead-colored boat now clear of the fort coming up on the two white boats. There's the Coast Guard boat, he thought. She's pitiful too. You think the seaplane will come? The pleasant-spoken boy asked. Be dark in half an hour, Harry said. He settled on the steering seat. What you figure on doing, killing me? I don't want to, the boy said. I hate killing. What you doing? Roberto, who sat now with a pint of whiskey in his hand, asked. Making friends with the captain? What you want to do, eat at the captain's table? Take the wheel, Harry said to the boy. See the course? 225. He straightened up from the stool and went aft. Let me have a drink, Harry said to Roberto. There's your Coast Guard boat, but she can't catch us. He had abandoned anger, hatred, and any dignity as luxuries now, and had started to plan. Sure, said Roberto. She can't catch us. Look at those seasick babies. What you say? You want a drink? You got any other last wishes, Cappy? You're some kidder, Harry said. He took a long drink.
Go easy, Roberto protested. That's all there is.
I got some more, Harry told him. I was just kidding you.
Don't kid me, said Roberto suspiciously.
Why should I try?
What you got?
Bacardi.
Bring it out.
Take it easy, Harry said. Why do you get so tough? He stepped over Albert's body as he walked forward. As he came to the wheel, he looked at the compass. The boy was about 25 degrees off, and the compass dial was swinging. He's no sailor, Harry thought. That gives me more time. Look at the wake. The wake ran in two bubbling curves toward where the light, astern now, showed brown, conical, and thinly latticed on the horizon. The boats were almost out of sight. He could just see a blur where the wireless masts of the town were. The engines were running smoothly. Harry put his head below and reached for one of the bottles of Bacardi. He went aft with it. At the stern he took a drink, then handed the bottle to Roberto. Standing, he looked down at Albert, and he felt sick inside. The poor hungry bastard, he thought.
What's the matter? He scare you?
The big-faced Cuban asked. What you say we put him over, Harry said. No sense to carry him.
Okay, said Roberto. You got good sense.
Take him under the arm, said Harry. I'll take the legs.
Roberto laid the Thompson gun down on the wide stern and, leaning down, lifted the body by the shoulders.
You know the heaviest thing in the world is a dead man, he said. You ever lift a dead man before, Cappy?
No, said Harry. You ever lift a big dead woman? Roberto pulled the body up onto the stern.
You're a tough fellow, he said. What do you say we have a drink?
Go ahead, said Harry.
Listen, I'm sorry I killed him, Roberto said. When I kill you, I feel worse.
Cut out talking that way, Harry said. What do you want to talk that way for?
Come on, said Roberto. Over he goes.
As they leaned over and slid the body up and over the stern, Harry kicked the machine gun over the edge. It splashed at the same time Albert did, but while Albert turned over twice in the white-churned, bubbling back suction of the propeller wash before sinking, the gun went straight down.
That's better, eh? Roberto said. Make it shipshape.
Then as he saw the gun was gone. Where is it? What did you do with it?
With what?
The ametralladora.
Going into Spanish in excitement.
The what?
You know what.
I didn't see it.
You knocked it off the stern.
Now I'll kill you, now.
Take it easy, said Harry.
What the hell are you going to kill me about?
Give me a gun, Roberto said to one of the seasick Cubans in Spanish. Give me a gun, quick.
Harry stood there, never having felt so tall, never having felt so wide, feeling the sweat trickle from under his armpits, feeling it go down his flanks.
You kill too much, he heard the seasick Cuban say in Spanish. You kill the mate, now you want to kill the captain? Who's going to get us across?
Leave him alone, said the other. Kill him when we get over.
He knocked the machine gun overboard, Roberto said.
We got the money. What you want a machine gun for now? There's plenty of machine guns in Cuba.
I tell you, you make a mistake if you don't kill him now. I tell you, give me a gun.
Oh, shut up. You're drunk. Every time you're drunk, you want to kill somebody.
Have a drink, said Harry, looking out across the gray swell of the Gulf Stream where the round red sun was just touching the water.
Watch that.
When she goes all the way under, it'll turn bright green.
The hell with that, said the big-faced Cuban. You think you got away with something.
I'll get you another gun, said Harry. They only cost $45 in Cuba. Take it easy. You're all right now. There ain't any Coast Guard plane going to come now.
I'm going to kill you, Roberto said, looking him over. You did that on purpose. That's why you got me to lift on that.
You don't want to kill me, Harry said. Who's going to take you across?
I ought to kill you now. Take it easy, said Harry. I'm going to look at the engines.
He opened the hatch, got down in, screwed down the grease cups on the two stuffing boxes, felt of the motors, and with his hand touched the butt of the Thompson gun.
Not yet, he thought. No, better not yet. Christ, that was lucky. What the hell difference does it make to Albert when he's dead? Saves his old woman to bury him. That big-faced bastard. That big-faced murdering bastard. Christ, I'd like to take him now. But I better wait.
He stood up, climbed out, and shut the hatch.
How you doing? He said to Roberto.
He put his hand on the fat shoulder. The big-faced Cuban looked at him and did not say anything.
Did you see it turn green? Harry asked.
The hell with you, Roberto said.
He was drunk, but he was suspicious, and like an animal, he knew how wrong something had gone. Let me take her a while, Harry said to the boy at the wheel. What's your name?
You can call me Emilio, said the boy.
Go below and you'll find something to eat, Harry said. There's bread and corned beef. Make coffee if you want.
I don't want any.
I'll make some later, Harry said. He sat at the wheel, the binnacle light on now, holding her on the point easily in the light following sea, looking out at the night coming on the water. He had no running lights on.
It would be a pretty night to cross, he thought. A pretty night. Soon as the last of that afterglow is gone, I've got to work her east. If I don't, we'll sight the glare of Havana in another hour. In two, anyway. Soon as he sees the glare, it may occur to that son of a bitch to kill me. That was lucky, getting rid of that gun. Damn, that was lucky. Wonder what Marie's having for supper. I guess she's plenty worried. I guess she's too worried to eat. Wonder how much money those bastards have got. Funny they don't count it. If that ain't a hell of a way to raise money for a revolution. Cubans are a hell of a people. That's a mean boy, that Roberto. I'll get him tonight. I'll get him no matter how the rest of it comes out. That won't help that poor damned Albert, though. It made me feel bad to dump him like that. I don't know what made me think of it.
He lit a cigarette and smoked in the dark.
I'm doing all right, he thought. I'm doing better than I expected. The kid is a kind of nice kid. I wish I could get those other two on the same side. I wish there was some way to bunch them. Well, I'll have to do the best I can. The easier I can make them take it beforehand, the better. The smoother everything goes, the better.
Do you want a sandwich? The boy asked. Thanks, said Harry. You give one to your partner?
He's drinking. He won't eat, the boy said.
What about the others?
Seasick, the boy said.
It's a nice night to cross, Harry said. He noticed the boy did not watch the compass, so he kept letting her go off to the east.
I'd enjoy it, the boy said, if it wasn't for your mate.
He was a good fellow, said Harry. Did anyone get hurt at the bank?
The lawyer. What was his name? Simmons.
Get killed?
I think so. So, thought Harry, Mr. Beelips. What the hell did he expect? How could he have thought he wouldn't get it? That comes from playing at being tough. That comes from being too smart too often. Mr. Beelips. Goodbye, Mr. Beelips.
How he come to get killed?
I guess you can't imagine, the boy said. That's very different from your mate.
I feel badly about that. You know he doesn't mean to do wrong. It's just what that phase of the revolution has done to him.
I guess he's probably a good fellow, Harry said, and thought, listen to what my mouth says. God damn it, my mouth will say anything. But I got to try to make a friend of this boy in case...
What kind of revolution do you make now? He asked.
We are the only true revolutionary party, the boy said. We want to do away with all the old politicians, with all the American imperialism that strangles us, with the tyranny of the army. We want to start clean and give every man a chance. We want to end the slavery of the guajiros, you know, the peasants, and divide the big sugar estates among the people that work them. But we are not communists.
Harry looked up from the compass card at him.
How you coming on? He asked.
We just raise money now for the fight, the boy said. To do that, we have to use means that later we would never use. Also, we have to use people we would not employ later. But the end is worth the means. They had to do the same thing in Russia. Stalin was a sort of brigand for many years before the revolution.
He's a radical, Harry thought. That's what he is, a radical.
I guess you've got a good program, he said, if you're out to help the working man.
I was out on strike plenty times in the old days when we had the cigar factories in Key West. I'd have been glad to do whatever I could if I'd known what kind of outfit you were.
Lots of people would help us, the boy said. But because of the state the movement is in at present, we can't trust people. I regret the necessity for the present phase very much. I hate terrorism. I also feel very badly about the methods for raising the necessary money, but there is no choice. You do not know how bad things are in Cuba.
I guess they're plenty bad, Harry said.
You can't know how bad they are. There is an absolutely murderous tyranny that extends over every little village in the country. Three people cannot be together on the street. Cuba has no foreign enemies and doesn't need any army. But she has an army of 25,000 now, and the army, from the corporals up, sucked the blood from the nation. Every one, even the private soldiers, are out to make their fortunes. Now they have a military reserve with every kind of crook, bully, and informer of the old days of Machado in it, and they take anything the army does not bother with. We have to get rid of the army before anything can start. Before we were ruled by clubs. Now we are ruled by rifles, pistols, machine guns, and bayonets.
It sounds bad, Harry said, steering, and letting her go off to the eastward.
You cannot realize how bad it is, the boy said. I love my poor country, and I would do anything, anything to free it from this tyranny we have now. I do things I hate, but I would do things I hate 1,000 times more.
I want a drink, Harry was thinking. What the hell do I care about his revolution? F his revolution.
To help the working man, he robs a bank and kills a fellow works with him and then kills that poor damned Albert that never did any harm. That's a working man he kills. He never thinks of that.
with a family. It's the Cubans run Cuba. They all double-cross each other. They sell each other out. They get what they deserve. The hell with their revolutions. All I got to do is make a living for my family, and I can't do that. Then he tells me about his revolution. The hell with his revolution. It must be bad, all right, he said to the boy. Take the wheel a minute, will you? I want to get a drink. Sure, said the boy. How should I steer? 225, Harry said. It was dark now, and there was quite a swell this far out in the Gulf Stream. He passed the two seasick Cubans lying out on the seats, and went aft to where Roberto sat in the fishing chair. The water was racing past the boat in the dark. Roberto sat with his feet in the other fishing chair that was turned toward him. Let me have some of that, Harry said to him. Go to hell, said the big-faced man thickly. This is mine. All right, said Harry, and went forward to get the other bottle. Below in the dark, with the bottle under the flap of his right arm, he pulled the cork that Freddy had drawn and reinserted, and took a drink. Now's as good as any time, he said to himself. No sense waiting now. Little boy spoke his piece. The big-faced bastard drunk. The other two seasick. It might as well be now. He took another drink, and the Bacardi warmed and helped him, but he felt cold and hollow all around his stomach still. His whole insides were cold. Want a drink? He asked the boy at the wheel. No thanks, the boy said. I don't drink. Harry could see him smile in the binnacle light. He was a nice-looking boy, all right. Pleasant talking, too. I'll take one, he said. He swallowed a big one, but it could not warm the dank, cold part that had spread from his stomach to all over the inside of his chest now. He put the bottle down on the cockpit door. Keep her on that course, he said to the boy. I'm going to have a look at the motors. He opened the hatch and stepped down, then locked the hatch up with a long hook that set into a hole in the flooring. He stooped over the motors. With his one hand felt the water manifold, the cylinders, and put his hand on the stuffing boxes. He tightened the two grease cups a turn and a half each. Quit stalling, he said to himself. Come on, quit stalling.
Where are your balls now? Under my chin, I guess, he thought.
He looked out of the hatch. He could almost touch the two seats over the gas tanks where the seasick men lay. The boy's back was toward him, sitting on the high stool, outlined clearly by the binnacle light. Turning, he could see Roberto sprawled in the chair in the stern, silhouetted against the dark water. 21 to a clip is 4 bursts of 5 at the most, he thought. I got to be light-fingered. All right, come on. Quit stalling, you gutless wonder. Christ, what I'd give for another one. Well, there isn't any other one now.
He reached his left hand up, unhooked the length of belting, put his hand around the trigger guard, pushed the safety all the way over with his thumb and pulled the gun out. Squatting in the engine pit, he sighted carefully on the base of the back of the boy's head, where it outlined against the light from the binnacle. The gun made a big flame in the dark, and the shells rattled against the lighted hatch and onto the engine. Before the slump of the boy's body fell from the stool, he had turned and shot into the figure on the left bunk, holding the jerking, flame-stabbing gun almost against the man, so close he could smell it burn his coat, then swung to put a burst into the other bunk where the man was sitting up, tugging at his pistol. He crouched low now and looked astern. The big-faced man was gone out of the chair. He could see both chairs silhouetted. Behind him, the boy lay still. There wasn't any doubt about him. On one bunk, a man was flopping. On the other, he could see with the corner of his eye, a man lay half over the gunwale, fallen over on his face. Harry was trying to locate the big-faced man in the dark. The boat was going in a circle now, and the cockpit lightened a little. He held his breath and looked. That must be him where it was a little darker on the floor in the corner. He watched it, and it moved a little. That was him. The man was crawling toward him. No, toward the man who lay half overboard. He was after his gun. Crouching low, Harry watched him move until he was absolutely sure. Then he gave him a burst. The gun lighted him on hands and knees, and as the flame and the bot-bot-bot-bot stopped, he heard him flopping heavily.
"You son of a bitch," said Harry. "You big-faced murdering bastard."
All the cold was gone from around his heart now, and he had the old hollow singing feeling, and he crouched low down and felt under the square wood-crated gas tank for another clip to put in the gun. He got the clip, but his hand was cold, drying wet. "Hit the tank," he said to himself. "I've got to cut the engines. I don't know where that tank cuts." He pressed the curved lever, dropped the empty clip, shoved in the fresh one, and climbed up and out of the cockpit. As he stood up, holding the Thompson gun in his left hand, looking around before shutting the hatch with the hook on his right arm, the Cuban who had lain on the port bunk and had been shot 3 times through the left shoulder, 2 shots going into the gas tank, sat up, took careful aim, and shot him in the belly. Harry sat down in a backward lurch. He felt as though he'd been struck in the abdomen with a club. His back was against one of the iron pipe supports of the fishing chairs, and while the Cuban shot at him again and splintered the fishing chair above his head, he reached down, found the Thompson gun, raised it carefully, holding the forward grip with the hook, and rattled half of the fresh clip into the man who sat leaning forward, calmly shooting at him from the seat. The man was down on the seat in a heap, and Harry felt around on the cockpit floor until he could find the big-faced man, who lay face down, felt for his head with the hook on his bad arm, hooked it around, then put the muzzle of the gun against the head and touched the trigger. Touching the head, the gun made a noise like hitting a pumpkin with a club. Harry put down the gun and lay on his side on the cockpit floor.
"I'm a son of a bitch," he said, his lips against the planking. "I'm a gone son of a bitch now. I got to cut the engines or we'll all burn up," he thought. "I got a chance still. I got a kind of a chance. Jesus Christ, one thing to spoil it. One thing to go wrong. God damn it! Oh, God damn that Cuban bastard! Who'd have thought I hadn't got him?"
He got on his hands and knees and, letting one side of the hatch over the engine slam down, crawled over it forward to where the steering stool was. He pulled up on it, surprised to find how well he could move, then suddenly feeling faint and weak as he stood erect. He leaned forward with his bad arm resting on the compass and cut the 2 switches. The engines were quiet, and he could hear the water against her sides. There was no other sound. She swung into the trough of the little sea the north wind had raised and began to roll. He hung against the wheel, then eased himself onto the steering stool, leaning against the chart table. He could feel the strength drain out of him in a steady, faint nausea. He opened his shirt with his good hand and felt the hole with the base of the palm of his hand, then fingered it. There was very little bleeding. All inside, he thought. I better lie down and give it a chance to quiet. The moon was up now, and he could see what was in the cockpit. Some mess, he thought. Some hell of a mess. Better get down before I fall down, he thought, and he lowered himself down to the cockpit floor. He lay on his side, and then as the boat rolled, the moonlight came in and he could see everything in the cockpit clearly.
"It's crowded," he thought. "That's what it is. It's crowded." Then he thought, "I wonder what she'll do. I wonder what Marie will do. Maybe they'll pay her the rewards. God damn that Cuban. She'll get along, I guess. She's a smart woman. I guess we would all have gotten along. I guess it was nuts, all right. I guess I bit off too much more than I could chew. I shouldn't have tried it. I had it all right up to the end. Nobody'll know how it happened. I wish I could do something about Marie. Plenty money on this boat. I don't even know how much. Anybody'd be okay with that money. I wonder if the Coast Guard will pinch it. Some of it, I guess. I wish I could let the old woman know what happened. I wonder what she'll do. I don't know. I guess I should have got a job in a filling station or something. I should have quit trying to go in boats.
There's no honest money going in boats anymore. If the bitch wouldn't only roll. If she'd only quit rolling. I could feel all that slopping back and forth inside. Me, Mr. B-Lips, and Albert. Everybody that had to do with it. These bastards, too. It must be an unlucky business. Some unlucky business. I guess what a man like me ought to do is run something like a filling station. Hell, I couldn't run no filling station. Marie, she'll run something. She's too old to peddle her hips now. I wish this bitch wouldn't roll. I just have to take it easy. I got to take it as easy as I can. They say if you don't drink water and lay still. They say especially if you don't drink water.
He looked at what the moonlight showed in the cockpit.
Well, I don't have to clean her up, he thought. Take it easy. That's what I gotta do. Take it easy. I've gotta take it as easy as I can. I've got sort of a chance. If you lay still and don't drink any water.
He lay on his back and tried to breathe steadily. The launch rolled in the Gulf Stream swell and Harry Morgan lay on his back in the cockpit. At first, he tried to brace himself against the roll with his good hand. Then he lay quietly and took it. Chapter 19. The next morning in Key West, Richard Gordon was on his way home from a visit to Freddy's bar where he had gone to ask about the bank robbery. Riding his bicycle, he passed a heavy-set, big blue-eyed woman, with bleached blonde hair showing under her old man's felt hat, hurrying across the road, her eyes red from crying. Look at that big ox, he thought. What do you suppose a woman like that thinks about? What do you suppose she does in bed? How does her husband feel about her when she gets that size? Who do you suppose he runs around with in this town? Wasn't she an appalling-looking woman? Like a battleship. Terrific.
He was almost home now. He left his bicycle on the front porch and went in the hallway, closing the front door the termites had tunneled and riddled.
What did you find out, Dick? His wife called from the kitchen.
Don't talk to me, he said. I'm going to work. I have it all in my head.
That's fine, she said. I'll leave you alone.
He sat down at the big table in the front room. He was writing a novel about a strike in a textile factory. In today's chapter, he was going to use the big woman with the tear-reddened eyes he had just seen on the way home. Her husband, when he came home at night, hated her, hated the way she had coarsened and grown heavy, was repelled by her bleached hair, her too big breasts, her lack of sympathy with his work as an organizer. He would compare her to the young, firm-breasted, full-lipped little Jewess that had spoken at the meeting that evening. It was good. It was. It could be easily terrific, and it was true. He had seen in a flash of perception the whole inner life of that type of woman. Her early indifference to her husband's caresses, her desire for children and security, her lack of sympathy with her husband's aims, her sad attempts to simulate an interest in the sexual act that had become actually repugnant to her. It would be a fine chapter. The woman he had seen was Harry Morgan's wife, Marie, on her way home from the sheriff's office.
Chapter 20. Freddie Wallace's boat, the Queen Conch, 34 feet long, with a V number out of Tampa, was painted white. The forward deck was painted a color called Frolic Green, and the inside of the cockpit was painted Frolic Green. The top of the house was painted the same color. Her name and home port, Key West, Florida, were painted in black across her stern. She was not equipped with outriggers and had no mast. She was equipped with glass windshields, one of which, that forward of the wheel, was broken. There were a number of fresh, wood-splintered holes in the newly painted planking of her hull. Splintered patches could be seen on both sides of her hull about a foot below the gunwale and a little forward of the center of the cockpit.
There was another group of these splintered places almost at the waterline on the starboard side of the hull opposite the aft stanchion that supported her house or awning. From the lower of these holes, something dark had dripped and hung in ropey lines against the new paint of her hull. She drifted broadside to the gentle north wind about 10 miles outside of the northbound tanker lanes, gay-looking in her fresh white and green against the dark blue Gulf Stream water. There were patches of sun-yellowed sargasso weed floating in the water near her that passed her slowly in the current going to the north and east, while the wind overcame some of the launch's drift as it set her steadily further out into the stream. There was no sign of life on her, although the body of a man showed, rather inflated-looking above the gunwale, lying on a bench over the port gasoline tank, and from the long seat alongside the starboard gunwale, a man seemed to be leaning over to dip his hand into the sea. His head and arms were in the sun, and at the point where his fingers almost touched the water, there was a school of small fish, about 2 inches long, oval-shaped, golden-colored, with faint purple stripes, that had deserted the gulf weed to take shelter in the shade the bottom of the drifting launch made in the water. And each time anything dripped down into the sea, these fish rushed at the drop and pushed and milled until it was gone. 2 gray suckerfish about 18 inches long swam round and round the boat in the shadow in the water, their slit mouths on the tops of their flat heads opening and shutting. But they did not seem to comprehend the regularity of the drip the small fish fed on, and were as likely to be on the far side of the launch when the drop fell as near it. They had long since pulled away the ropey carmine clots and threads that trailed in the water from the lowest splintered holes, shaking their ugly sucker-topped heads and their elongated, tapering, thin-tailed bodies as they pulled. They were reluctant now to leave a place where they had fed so well and unexpectedly. Inside the cockpit of the launch there were 3 other men. One, dead, lay on his back where he had fallen below the steering stool. Another, dead, lay humped big against the scupper by the starboard aft stanchion. The third, still alive, but long out of his head, lay on his side with his head on his arm. The bilge of the launch was full of gasoline, and when she rolled it all, this made a sloshing sound. The man, Harry Morgan, believed this sound was in his own belly. And it seemed to him now that his belly was big as a lake, and that it sloshed on both shores at once. That was because he was on his back now with his knees drawn up and his head back. The water of the lake that was his belly was very cold, so cold that when he stepped into its edge it numbed him, and he was extremely cold now, and everything tasted of gasoline as though he'd been sucking on a hose to siphon a tank. He knew there was no tank, although he could feel a cold rubber hose that seemed to have entered his mouth and now was coiled, big, cold, and heavy all down through him. Each time he took a breath, the hose coiled colder and firmer in his lower abdomen, and he could feel it like a big, smooth-moving snake in there above the sloshing of the lake. He was afraid of it. But although it was in him, it seemed a vast distance away, and what he minded now was the cold. The cold was all through him, an aching cold that would not numb away, and he lay quietly now and felt it. For a time he had thought that if he could pull himself up over himself, it would warm him like a blanket, and he thought for a while that he had gotten himself pulled up. And he'd started to warm. But that warmth was really only the hemorrhage produced by raising his knees up. And as the warmth faded, he knew now that you could not pull yourself up over yourself, and there was nothing to do about the cold but take it. He lay there, trying hard in all of him not to die long after he could not think. He was in the shadow now, as the boat drifted, and it was colder. All the time. The launch had been drifting since 10 o'clock of the night before, and it was now getting late in the afternoon. There was nothing else in sight across the surface of the Gulf Stream but the Gulf weed, a few pink, inflated, membranous bubbles of Portuguese men-of-war cocked jauntily on the surface, and the distant smoke of a loaded tanker bound north from Tampico. Chapter 21. "Well," Richard Gordon said to his wife. "You have lipstick on your shirt," she said, "and over your ear."
"What about this?"
"What about what? What about finding you lying on the couch with that drunken slob?" "You did not."
"Where did I find you?"
"You found us sitting on the couch."
"In the dark?"
"Where have you been?"
"At the Bradleys."
"Yes," she said, "I know. Don't come near me. You reek of that woman."
"What do you reek of?"
"Nothing. I've been sitting talking to a friend."
"Did you kiss him?"
"No."
"Did he kiss you?"
"Yes, I liked it."
"You bitch."
"If you call me that, I'll leave you."
"You bitch."
"All right," she said. "It's over. If you weren't so conceited and I weren't so good to you, you'd have seen it was over a long time ago."
"You bitch."
"No," she said, "I'm not a bitch. I've tried to be a good wife, but you're as selfish and conceited as a barnyard rooster. Always crowing, 'Look what I've done, look how I've made you happy. Now run along and cackle.' Well, you don't make me happy, and I'm sick of you. I'm through cackling."
"You shouldn't cackle. You never produced anything to cackle about."
"Whose fault was that? Didn't I want children? But we never could afford them. But we could afford to go to the Cap d'Antibes to swim and to Switzerland to ski. We can afford to come down here to Key West. I'm sick of you. I dislike you. This Bradley woman today was the last straw."
"Oh, leave her out of it."
"You coming home with lipstick all over you? Couldn't you even wash? There's some on your forehead, too."
"You kissed that drunken twerp?"
"No, I didn't, but I would have if I'd known what you were doing."
"Why did you let him kiss you?"
"I was furious at you. We waited and waited and waited. You never came near me. You went off with that woman and stayed for hours. John brought me home."
"Oh, John, is it?"
"Yes, John. John. John."
"And what's his last name, Thomas?"
"His name is McWalsey."
"Why don't you spell it?"
"I can't," she said, and laughed. But it was the last time she laughed. "Don't think it's all right because I laugh," she said, tears in her eyes, her lips working. "It's not all right. This isn't just an ordinary row. It's over. I don't hate you. It isn't violent. I just dislike you. I dislike you thoroughly, and I'm through with you."
"All right," he said.
"No, not all right. All over. Don't you understand?"
"I guess so."
"Don't guess.
Don't be so melodramatic, Helen."
"So I'm melodramatic, am I? Well, I'm not. I'm through with you."
"No, you're not."
"I won't say it again."
"What are you going to do?"
"I don't know yet. I may marry John McWalsey."
"You will not."
"I will if I wish."
"He wouldn't marry you."
"Oh, yes, he will. He asked me to marry him this afternoon." Richard Gordon said nothing. A hollow had come in him where his heart had been, and everything he heard or said seemed to be overheard.
"He asked you what?" he said, his voice coming from a long way away.
"To marry him."
"Why?"
"Because he loves me. Because he wants me to live with him. He makes enough money to support me."
"You're married to me."
"Not really. Not in the church.
You wouldn't marry me in the church, and it broke my poor mother's heart, as you well know.
I was so sentimental about you, I'd break anyone's heart for you. My, I was a damned fool. I broke my own heart, too. It's broken and gone. Everything I believed in, and everything I cared about, I left for you because you were so wonderful, and you loved me so much that love was all that mattered. Love was the greatest thing, wasn't it? Love was what we had that no one else had, or could ever have. And you were a genius, and I was your whole life. I was your partner, and your little black flower. Slop. Love is just another dirty lie.
Love is ergo apio pills to make me come around because you were afraid to have a baby. Love is quinine and quinine and quinine until I'm deaf with it. Love is that dirty aborting horror that you took me to. Love is my insides all messed up. It's half catheters and half whirling douches. I know about love. Love always hangs up behind the bathroom door. It smells like Lysol. To hell with love. Love is you making me happy, and then going off to sleep with your mouth open, while I lie awake all night afraid to say my prayers even because I know I have no right to anymore. Love is all the dirty little tricks you taught me that you probably got out of some book. All right. I'm through with you, and I'm through with love. Your kind of pick-nose love. You writer. You little mixed slut. Don't call me names. I know the word for you. All right. No, not all right. All wrong and wrong again. If you were just a good writer, I could stand for all the rest of it, maybe. But I've seen you bitter, jealous, changing your politics to suit the fashion, sucking up to people's faces and talking about them behind their backs. I've seen you until I'm sick of you. In that dirty rich bitch of a Bradley woman today. Oh, I'm sick of it. I've tried to take care of you, and humor you, and look after you, and cook for you, and keep quiet when you wanted, and cheerful when you wanted, and give you your little explosions and pretend it made me happy, and put up with your rages and jealousies and your meannesses, and now I'm through. So now you want to start again with a drunken professor? He's a man. He's kind, and he's charitable, and he makes you feel comfortable. And we come from the same thing, and we have values that you'll never have. He's like my father was. He's a drunk. He drinks, and so did my father. And my father wore wool socks and put his feet in them up on a chair and read the paper in the evening. And when we had croup, he took care of us. He was a boilermaker, and his hands were all broken, and he liked to fight when he drank, and he could fight when he was sober. He went to Mass because my mother wanted him to, and he did his Easter duty for her and for our Lord, but mostly for her. And he was a good union man, and if he ever went with another woman, she never knew it. I'll bet he went with plenty. Maybe he did, but if he did, he told the priest, not her. And if he did, it was because he couldn't help it, and he was sorry and repented of it. He didn't do it out of curiosity or from barnyard pride or to tell his wife what a great man he was. If he did, it was because my mother was away with us kids for the summer and he was out with the boys and got drunk. He was a man. You ought to be a writer and write about him. I'd be a better writer than you. And John McWalsey is a good man. That's what you're not. You couldn't be, no matter what your politics or your religion. I haven't any religion. Neither have I. But I had one once and I'm going to have one again. And you won't be there to take it away like you've taken away everything else. No. No. You can be in bed with some rich woman like Helene Bradley. How did she like you? Did she think you were wonderful? Looking at her sad, angry face, pretty with crying, the lips swollen freshly like something after rain, her curly dark hair wild about her face, Richard Gordon gave her up. Then finally, "And you don't love me anymore?" I hate the word, even. All right, he said, and slapped her hard and suddenly across the face. She cried now from actual pain, not anger, her face down on the table. You didn't need to do that, she said. Oh, yes, I did, he said. You know an awful lot, but you don't know how much I needed to do that. That afternoon, she had not seen him as the door opened. She had not seen anything but the white ceiling with its cake frosting modeling of cupids, doves, and scroll work that the light from the open door suddenly made clear. Richard Gordon had turned his head and seen him, standing heavy and bearded in the doorway. "Don't stop," Helene had said. "Please don't stop." Her bright hair was spread over the pillow. But Richard Gordon had stopped, and his head was still turned, staring. "Don't mind him. Don't mind anything. Don't you see you can't stop now?" the woman had said in desperate urgency. The bearded man had closed the door softly. He was smiling.
"What's the matter, darling?" Helene Bradley had asked, now in the darkness again.
"I must go."
"Don't you see you can't go?"
"That man,
that's only Tommy," Helene had said. "He knows all about these things. Don't mind him. Come on, darling, please do."
"I can't."
"You must," Helene had said. He could feel her shaking and her head on his shoulder was trembling. "My God, don't you know anything? Haven't you any regard for a woman?"
"I have to go," said Richard Gordon. In the darkness, he had felt the slap across his face that lighted flashes of light in his eyeballs. Then there was another slap, across his mouth this time.
"So that's the kind of man you are," she had said to him. "I thought you were a man of the world. Get out of here."
That was this afternoon. That was how it had finished at the Bradleys. Now his wife sat with her head forward on her hands that rested on the table, and neither of them said anything. Richard Gordon could hear the clock ticking, and he felt as hollow as the room was quiet. After a while, his wife said without looking at him, "I'm sorry it happened, but you see it's over, don't you?"
"Yes, if that's the way it's been."
"It hasn't been all like that, but for a long time it's been that way."
"I'm sorry I slapped you."
"Oh, that's nothing. That hasn't anything to do with it. That was just a way to say goodbye."
"Don't."
"I'll have to get out," she said very tiredly. "I'll have to take the big suitcase, I'm afraid."
"Do it in the morning," he said. "You can do everything in the morning."
"I'd rather do it now, Dick, and it would be easier. But I'm so tired. It's made me awfully tired and given me a headache."
"You do whatever you want."
"Oh, God," she said. "I wish it wouldn't have happened. But it's happened. I'll try to fix everything up for you. You'll need somebody to look after you. If I hadn't have said some of that, or if you hadn't hit me, maybe we could have fixed it up again."
"No, it was over before that."
"I'm so sorry for you, Dick."
"Don't you be sorry for me or I'll slap you again."
"I guess I'd feel better if you slapped me," she said. "I am sorry for you. Oh, I am."
"Go to hell."
"I'm sorry I said it about you not being good in bed. I don't know anything about that. I guess you're wonderful."
"You're not such a star," he said. She began to cry again.
"That's worse than slapping," she said.
"Well, what did you say?"
"I don't know. I don't remember. I was so angry and you hurt me so."
"Well, it's all over, so why be bitter?"
"Oh, I don't want it to be over. But it is, and there's nothing to do now."
"You'll have your rummy professor."
"Don't," she said. "Can't we just shut up and not talk anymore?"
"Yes."
"Will you?"
"Yes."
"I'll sleep out here."
"No, you can have the bed. You must. I'm going out for a while."
"Oh, don't go out."
"I've got to," he said.
"Goodbye," she said.
And he saw her face he always loved so much, that crying never spoiled, and her curly black hair, her small firm breasts under the sweater forward against the edge of the table. And he didn't see the rest of her that he'd loved so much and thought he had pleased but evidently hadn't been any good to that was all below the table. And as he went out the door, she was looking at him across the table, and her chin was on her hands, and she was crying.
Chapter 22.
He did not take the bicycle but walked down the street. The moon was up now, and the trees were dark against it, and he passed the frame houses with their narrow yards, light coming from the shuttered windows, the unpaved alleys with their double rows of houses. Conktown, where all was starched, well shuttered, virtue, failure, grits and boiled grunts, undernourishment, prejudice, righteousness, interbreeding and the comforts of religion. The open-doored, lighted Cuban bolito houses, shacks whose only romance was their names,
The Red House, Chicha's. The Prestone Church, its steeples sharp, ugly triangles against the moonlight. The big grounds and the long black-domed bulk of the convent, handsome in the moonlight. A filling station and a sandwich place, bright-lighted beside a vacant lot where a miniature golf course had been taken out. Past the brightly lit main street with the three drug stores, the music store, the five juice stores, three pool rooms, two barber shops, five beer joints, three ice cream parlors, the five poor and the one good restaurant, two magazine and paper places, four second-hand joints, one of which made keys, a photographer's, an office building with four dentist's offices upstairs, the big dime store, a hotel on the corner with taxis opposite, and across, behind the hotel, to the street that led to Jungle Town, the big unpainted frame house with lights and the girls in the doorway, the mechanical piano going, and a sailor sitting in the street, and then on back, past the back of the brick courthouse with its clock luminous at 10:30, past the whitewashed jail building shining in the moonlight, to the embowered entrance of the Lilac Time, where motor cars filled the alley. The Lilac Time was brightly lighted and full of people, and as Richard Gordon went in, he saw the gambling room was crowded, the wheel turning and the little ball clicking brittle against metal partitions set in the bowl, the wheel turning slowly, the ball whirring, then clicking jumpily until it settled, and there was only the turning of the wheel and the rattling of the chips. At the bar, the proprietor, who was serving with two bartenders, said, "Hello, hello, Miss Gordon. What you have?" "I don't know," said Richard Gordon. "You don't look good. What's the matter? You don't feel good?" "No." "I fix you something just fine. Fix you up hokey. You ever try a Spanish absinthe or hen?"
"Go ahead," said Gordon.
"You drink him, you feel good. Want to fight anybody in the house," said the proprietor. "Make Mr. Gordon a or hen special."
Standing at the bar, Richard Gordon drank three O'Hen specials, but he felt no better. The opaque, Swedish, cold, licorice-tasting drink did not make him feel any different. "Give me something else," he said to the bartender.
"What's the matter? You no like a O'Hen special?"
the proprietor asked.
"You no feel good?"
"No."
"You got to be careful what you drink after him."
"Give me a straight whiskey." The whiskey warmed his tongue and the back of his throat, but it did not change his ideas any. And suddenly, looking at himself in the mirror behind the bar, he knew that drinking was never going to do any good to him now. Whatever he had now, he had, and it was from now on. And if he drank himself unconscious when he woke up, it would be there. A tall, very thin young man, with a sparse stubble of blonde beard on his chin, who was standing next to him at the bar, said,
"Aren't you Richard Gordon?"
"Yes."
"I'm Herbert Spellman. We met at a party in Brooklyn one time, I believe."
"Maybe," said Richard Gordon. "Why not?"
"I liked your last book very much," said Spellman. "I liked them all."
"I'm glad," said Richard Gordon. "Have a drink?"
"Have one with me," said Spellman. "Have you tried this O'Hen?"
"It's not doing me any good."
"What's the matter?"
"Feeling low."
"Wouldn't try another?"
"No, I'll have whiskey."
"You know, it's something to me to meet you," Spellman said. "I don't suppose you remember me at that party."
"No, but maybe it was a good party. You're not supposed to remember a good party, are you?"
"I guess not," said Spellman. "It was at Margaret Van Brunt's. Do you remember?"
he asked hopefully. "I'm trying to."
"I was the one set fire to the place," Spellman said.
"No," said Gordon.
"Yes," said Spellman happily. "That was me. That was the greatest party I was ever on."
"What are you doing now?" Gordon asked.
"Not much," said Spellman. "I get around a little. I'm taking it sort of easy now. Are you writing a new book?"
"Yes, about half done.
That's great, said Spellman. What's it about?
A strike in a textile plant.
That's marvelous, said Spellman. You know, I'm a sucker for anything on the social conflict.
What?
I love it, said Spellman. I go for it above anything else. You're absolutely the best of the lot. Listen, has it got a beautiful Jewish agitator in it?
Why? Asked Richard Gordon suspiciously.
It's a part for Sylvia Sidney. I'm in love with her. Want to see her picture?
I've seen it, said Richard Gordon.
Let's have a drink, said Spellman happily. Think of meeting you down here. You know, I'm a lucky fellow. Really lucky.
Why? Asked Richard Gordon.
I'm crazy, said Spellman. Gee, it's wonderful. It's just like being in love, only it always comes out right.
Richard Gordon edged away a little.
Don't be that way, said Spellman. I'm not violent. That is, I'm almost never violent. Come on, let's have a drink.
Have you been crazy long?
I think always, said Spellman. I tell you, it's the only way to be happy in times like these. What do I care what Douglas Aircraft does? What do I care what AT&T does? They can't touch me. I just pick up one of your books, or I take a drink, or I look at Sylvia's picture, and I'm happy. I'm like a bird. I'm better than a bird.
He seemed to hesitate and hunt for a word, then hurried on.
I'm a lovely little stork.
He blurted out and blushed. He looked at Richard Gordon fixedly, his lips working, and a large, blonde young man detached himself from a group down the bar and coming toward him put a hand on his arm. Come on, Harold, he said. We'd better be getting home. Spellman looked at Richard Gordon wildly.
He sneered at a stork, he said. He stepped away from a stork. A stork that wheels in circling flight.
Come on, Harold, said the big young man. Spellman put out his hand to Richard Gordon.
No offense, he said. You're a good writer. Keep right on with it. Remember, I'm always happy. Don't let them confuse you.
See you soon. With the large young man's arm over his shoulder, the two of them moved out through the crowd to the door. Spellman looked back and winked at Richard Gordon.
Nice fella, the proprietor said. He tapped his head. Very well educate. Studies too much, I guess. Likes to break glasses. He don't mean no harm. Pay for everything he break.
Does he come in here much?
In the evening. What'd he say he was? A swan?
A stork.
Other night was a horse. With wings. Like a horse on a white horse bottle, only with paired wings. Nice fellow, all right. Plenty money. Gets a funny ideas. Family keep him down here now with his manager. He told me he like your books, Mr. Gordon. What you have to drink? On the house.
A whiskey, said Richard Gordon. He saw the sheriff coming toward him. The sheriff was an extremely tall, rather cadaverous, and very friendly man. Richard Gordon had seen him that afternoon at the Bradleys' party and talked with him about the bank robbery.
Say, said the sheriff, if you're not doing anything, come along with me a little later. The Coast Guard's towing in Harry Morgan's boat. A tanker signaled it up off Matacombe. They've got the whole outfit.
My God, said Richard Gordon, they've got them all?
They're all dead, except one man, the message said.
You don't know who it is?
No, they didn't say. God knows what happened.
Have they got the money?
Nobody knows. But it must be aboard if they didn't get to Cuba with it.
When will they be in?
Oh, it will be 2 or 3 hours, yeah?
Where will they bring the boat?
Into the Navy Yard, I suppose, where the Coast Guard ties up.
Where'll I see you to go down there?
I'll drop in here for you.
Here or down at Freddy's, I can't stick it here much longer.
It's pretty tough in at Freddy's tonight. It's full of those vets from up on the Keys. They always raise the devil.
I'll go down there and look at it, Richard Gordon said. I'm feeling kind of low.
Well, keep out of trouble, the sheriff said. I'll pick you up there in a couple of hours. Want a lift down there?
Thanks. They went out through the crowd and Richard Gordon got in beside the sheriff in his car. What do you suppose happened in Morgan's boat, he asked.
God knows, the sheriff said. It sounds pretty grisly.
Didn't they have any other information?
Not a thing, said the sheriff. Now look at that, will you?
They were opposite the brightly lighted open front of Freddy's place, and it was jammed to the sidewalk. Men in dungarees, some bareheaded, others in caps, old service hats and in cardboard helmets, crowded the bar three deep, and the loud-speaking nickel in the slot phonograph was playing Isle of Capri.